The homework was, what was the interpretation of the slope of the non horizontal edge? And you see, in a planar markup chain, if you have a face, then there's a winding number associated to that face. Your chain might wind more this way around it than the other way. And the slope is, in fact, just related to the winding number. You know, if it's a reversible markup chain, then the winding number of each face is zero. So that's responsible to the fact
that the probability is one way and the other way, and it's a big difference. Is that the statement?
No, what you do is you take a long random walk, starting from some point, and you count how many times you wound around this face.
But it's not simply related to local probabilities on the edges here?
No, it's definitely not a local thing. It depends on all the probabilities. And you might find more once than the other, than the other way. The average amount of spinning you do around this space is a real number, and that's, well, has a simple linear relation to the slope of that edge. So zero corresponds to vertical, and non-zero corresponds to and it can be positive or negative depending on whether it goes this way.
And in the case of, is there any simple way of understanding the rationality or absence thereof of these winding numbers? Supposing the PIJs are rational.
Yeah, I think you can compute the winding number through some rational equations in the PIJs. Right? Because the winding number of two adjacent edges just depends on two adjacent faces, just depends on how many times you cross this way minus the number of times you cross that way. Okay, anyway, I want to get on, since we have more material to cover here. So far, I've been essentially talking about harmonic functions. That's the underlying construction on the graph which gives you this geometry. And in fact, all the probability models which I had stated at the beginning last talk did have some notion of harmonic function which was relevant for the probability. So what I want to do is talk about discrete analytic functions. In the sense that they are relevant to, in the diagram. Because this is the origin of these guys, but I really feel like this is a very natural concept and should live independently of your underlying probability process that you're doing on it. So, and the claim is that the harmonic functions which we dealt with up to now are special cases of this construction. So we're going to have a graph G, a planar. Bipartite now. Okay, so bipartite just means that there are, you color the edges black and white, and color the vertices black and white, and the black vertices are only adjacent to the white vertices, and vice versa. So the vertices come in two colors, black and white, and the edges go only. Which is by part that all the faces have to have even number of edges. Mm-hmm. Okay, so By the way, what I'm going to talk about during this half is joint work with Scott Sheffield. Okay, so Castellane. Showed how to compute the dimer model on a bipartite planar graph with a determinant. This involves putting some signs on the edges. All right, so this is going to look a little strange for a moment, but hopefully, you can either believe me that this is a very natural thing to do, or you might be convinced by the end of the talk. So we're going to put signs on the edges. Plus or minus one, and with the following rule. According to the rule, so this is from the 60s, 1965. Around each face, the number of minus signs is just going to be a function of the length of that face, the length of that face, and it's going to be each face is going to be an odd number of minus signs if you have 0 mod 4 edges, otherwise an even number. Each face has odd number of signs, of minus signs, if 0 mod 4 edges. Each face with k edges, if k is 0 mod 4, and if k is 2 mod 4, which is the other case because it's always even, then you have an even number of minus signs. So let's see. If I put a minus sign there and a minus sign there, and all the other signs are plus, then this will work, okay? Because I've got an even number of minus signs when there's 6, and here this is a 4, so it's got to have an odd number. And that's a 4, so it's got to have an odd number. Okay, so now let's make this a weighted. So with edge weights, edge weighted planar bipartite graph. So there's a function.
What's the statement about this rule? Gives you the number of dimer coverings, or?
Let me give you a statement in a moment. Okay. This is just a rule for the moment. Definition. We're going to have some function on the edges, non-negative function on the edges, which is going to be weights. Now we're going to define a discrete analytic function f . Let me first define the Castellane matrix.
But is it the unique way you can do that?
No. Okay, but that's a good question. So landmark. Well, if I have one way to do this, then what I can do to get a new way is to, at some vertex, change the sign on all the edges coming out of that vertex. So note that if I change the signs on a single vertex, then if the rule was satisfied before, it's now satisfied after as well. And the claim is that any two ways to assign these signs are related by this sequence of operations. This is lemma. This choice of sign is unique up to operations of this time. take the adjacency matrix of this graph with these signs, that's called the Castellane matrix. So the graph is bipartite, it's going to be, might as well just take half the adjacency matrix, the adjacencies from the black vertices to the white vertices, where K, BW is going to be plus or minus the weight on that edge, BW. W, B is a black vertex and W is a white vertex. And this is just the adjacency matrix with the signs thrown in. Okay? And I should probably call this A and A Castellane matrix because this choice of signs is not unique. On the other hand, this operation here just corresponds to precomposing this matrix with a diagonal matrix of plus or minus one. This is actually counting one of these probability models on the graph of the dimer model. This is the partition function of the dimer model. It's the sum over all perfect matchings. I'll tell you what that perfect matching is of the weight. Perfect matching of C. And a perfect matching of a graph is a choice of edges it's a choice of edges which covers all the vertices exactly once, and the weight of so C is a perfect matching. The reason it's called a perfect matching is because it matches every white vertex to a unique black vertex. And the weight is just going to be the product of the edge weights of the edges which are used. Each edge here has a weight, BW, nu, the weight of C, product of the edges.
Sorry, the key is not square in general.
That's correct.
So what's the determinant of?
If it's not square, then there are no perfect matchings and the determinant is zero. Mm-hmm. If it's not square, then there's more white vertices than black vertices, so you can't match every white vertex to a unique black vertex, and so it's zero. So this is an interesting matrix. The dimer model is one of these statistical mechanical models, probability models. There's a lot more to say about it. You could give a whole course on the dimer model, but this is the fundamental combinatorial result which allows you to say something interesting about it. Yeah, it's free fermions. If you're a physicist, you can dismiss it by saying it's just free fermion. there's a lot to say. Okay, so what's a discrete analytic function now? It's a function in the kernel of K. So in the previous talk, we were talking about harmonic functions. They are in the kernel of the Laplace operator. Here, we've got this operator K now, which is playing the role of our EBAR operator. A function f on the black vertices or the white vertices, it doesn't matter, or is discrete analytic if kf equals zero.
Can you, given this constraint, is there something that we know about the spectrum of K? Are all the...
K, right, at the moment, K can be
arbitrary.
So can I
have positive or negative eigenvalues?
The eigenvalues are, yes, maybe even complex.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are no zero eigenvalues as long as we have a perfect matching.
Exactly.
And we know there are no zero eigenvalues because the determinant is non-zero. And that those are the matrices we're going to be dealing with, only those matrices which actually have, for which the determinant is non-zero, otherwise the construction is not going to work. Because this...
So therefore, the kernel is empty.
The kernel is empty, that's right. Just like in the previous case, there are no non-constant harmonic functions.
Unless you put the...
Unless there's some boundary conditions. So we're interested in functions which... have some values on the boundary, some where kf is non-zero on the boundary, but the internal vertices, we want this to be true. So maybe I should give a little example.
Is it related to Laplacian?
Yes, good question. How is k related to Laplacian? There's no a priori obvious
sure,
relation.
K star k should be Laplacian. In the right star.
Right. What is K star? Yeah. Well, it's not the case. If you look at K star K, it's going to be some complicated graph. On the other hand, on certain graphs, you're definitely correct. So let's take Z2.
Do you need the dual lattice to be bipartite?
No.
To have the dual case star?
No.
I mean, if you create the dual lattice and it's not bipartite, then there's no way of defining this thing, right?
No. This is defined for any planar bipartite graph.
No, but I'm
whether
saying
the dual graph
may not be bipartite.
That's correct. The dual graph may not be bipartite.
On the dual graph, you cannot define this. So
that's correct.
That would be an initial candidate for this. A joint operator.
I don't think so. Anyway, we're going to see, I think, time permitting, these questions will be resolved. Okay. But these are all good questions. Okay, you're asking the right questions. Let's take a little piece of Z2. Okay. One way to put every face is a quadrilateral, so we have to have an odd number of minus signs on each face. So one way to do it is on alternating vertical edges put minus signs. Okay, well, this is not the most enlightening way to do it. But let me do it in a slightly different way.
Every other row.
Huh?
Every other row.
Yes, that would also work. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to cheat here. Oh gosh.
Yeah,
I'm going to put some complex numbers instead of signs. So the real condition, do I have the condition there? So let me say, put complex numbers, so e to the I theta on edges, according to the rule, this is just it's really the same thing going on, it's just that the all the, suppose we have a, this is going to generalize the previous rule, and you guys are all going to be confused, but you take the alternating product of the signs, A over B, C over D, E over F, and then it's going to be plus or minus 1 when you get around, depending on the length of the face. Okay?
Does this function have to be real? You define it to be real. Does it have to be real? C, okay.
No, because now I'm going to put complex numbers.
Yes.
Let's just make it complex in general. I have one to call that. The definition does depend on this matrix.
Okay, so
on the other hand, that's right, which is kind of an unfortunate thing. On the other hand, the lemma is still true with this rule. You're just going to put the new non-uniqueness is defined by you take a vertex and you multiply all the edges there by some complex number. Essentially multiplying the values of f at the vertices by some constants which depend, and there's some, it's like a gauge transformation, if you like. The ratio of values of f, well, okay.
Like a local gauge transformation.
Sorry?
Like a local gauge transformation.
Yes. Okay, if I put these weights on z2, it has the property that 1 divided by minus I times minus 1 divided by I, I get 1 times minus 1 in the numerator, and minus I times I in the denominator still comes out to be minus 1. So this is again equivalent to the previous guys. But if I have a function on these white vertices, so what is kf at this point here? Let's call that point that maybe he's not, maybe there's some truth in what I'm saying. Okay, what does all this have to do with tilings now? So now we're going to do the thing which I did last time, construct from a discrete analytic function a tiling. But now the tiling is not going to be with trapezoids or squares, it's going to be with general convex polygons. In the examples that I did, they were squares or trapezoids, and they were all convex. Okay, so in this case, they're going to be convex also.
Because you had a picture where you had nine.
That was a theorem which that was a rationality theorem. But yes, you're right.
Okay.
So we're slightly not quite that general at the moment. But yeah. So I'm going I'm gonna explain this arrow first. That's the easy one. So maybe a word of motivation is in order. How many people feel like this is an interesting thing and I don't need to motivate anymore? Because the motivation will take 5 minutes. Okay.
Good.
So we're going to tie a triangle with some convex. So let me tell you what I mean by tying with convex polygons. So this thing is bad because this thing is in some sense degenerate, a degenerate case of this. Can everybody see? Maybe I'll go to the higher end.
I don't see the difference in the case of trivalent vertices because they exist in both.
There's not going to be any trivalent vertices in the pictures that I draw.
But there is
trivalent vertices.
On the left, there are trivalent vertices.
Yes, but this one has an edge which goes all the way through. This one doesn't.
You mean it's just a.
This is a straight line.
Yes,
these are three straight lines. So all my vertices have the property that there's going to be a half plane. Passing through those.
So it's a geometric statement, not a graph theoretic statement.
Yes, yeah. Geometric statement. So my graph is going to be in red, and there's going to be a white vertex for every tile, plus, and I'm going to stick with the simplest boundary conditions just for the sake of exposition here, and there's going to be a black vertex for every maximal straight line segment. So this black vertex corresponds to this line segment. And I can put the vertex somewhere along that line segment. It doesn't really matter where. And two vertices are going to be connected if one is a tile and one is an edge of that tile. So this tile is a quadrilateral. It's got four neighbors. There. So I'm constructing the graph
another vertex at the bottom, outside external vertex on the bottom.
So the bottom, I'm not going to put any vertex here because that's the sort of the special of the base.
Okay.
Okay, so did I forget anybody? Looks okay. So that's the graph. And well, I have to give you the weights. So. The weight of this edge, let me just outline this edge. Its weight, so this edge connects this polygon with this horizontal segment, mm-hmm. and the weight is this length, the length of the polygon which it shares
yes.
in common with that. So this length, L, that's the weight that I put on that edge. Okay, so everything is very geometric. Uh, is that if with these boundary conditions, there's the same number of black vertices as white vertices. If I've done, if I haven't made a mistake. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 white, and 1, 2, 3 Well, there's 3 on the boundary. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 black. This follows from essentially Euler's. Just count the number of faces, vertices, and edges, and that'll work out. Okay, well, so big deal. I've got a convex polygon I constructed a graph with some weights on it. But the interesting part is to go backwards and show that this is actually a sort of, in some sense, a one-to-one correspondence. Here's one of my maximal horizontal edges. Every vertex here ends on a has a half plane, so it ends on two half planes. There might be some. Let's just do the simplest case when there's only three guys here. So there's a black vertex here, there's a black vertex there, and there's. Trouble is because I want to do it in the reverse direction. let me postpone. You're trying to go too fast. Anyway, I've done this part. Let me explain this part, and then we'll eventually get to this definition of where the signs are. Okay. So we have our matrix. We have our graph G, and our matrix K. Estimate matrix, and we're going to construct these two functions f and g, which are discrete analytic functions. So f is going to be a discrete analytic function on the black vertices, and g is going to be one on the white vertices. G, and in fact. Is going to be a real matrix for this discussion. So it's just going to be a, have some sign, just the plus or minus signs for now. And F and G, F is going to go from the black vertices to the, one of them is real and one of them is complex. So F is going to be complex and it's going to be defined on the black vertices. So the boundary conditions are going to determine whether it's real or complex. So we want to make a tiling of a triangle. This is, this, again, the simplest boundary conditions. And our graph is special in the sense, notice that when I constructed this graph, it had two special vertices, these guys, which were sort of dangling. Okay. This is just for the sake of the current boundary conditions. You can deal with a more general case, but let's deal with the graph which has these two special dangling vertices. Let's call them W1 and W2.
So
not always why it's not the same face, it's just...
That's the outer face of the graph.
But it's unique, if there are two of them here, why is it two of them?
I'm just going to stick with this graph for now. Hand me a graph which has these two little feelers, okay, on it. And I'm going to make the construction there, and you can believe me that for a general graph without these guys, there's a more general construction. Okay, so here's our triangle, right? This is the triangle sitting there in the complex plane, and it has two vectors, which we're going to call Q1 and Q2 and Q0. Q0, Q1, Q2 are complex numbers, and the sum is 0. And these are essentially giving the boundary conditions of our discrete analytic function. So function except at the boundary. Okay. What happens on the interior? The boundary conditions are always slightly annoying because they're special cases, but we have to bite the bullet and so we're going to have AWB, F of B. This is the sum over B. Now if we sum over W, G of W, this is going to be, I'm going to do it backwards. I apologize, I did it backwards. So, step one. This is going to be 0 or 1. This bottom vertex here is a special black vertex. One if B equals B zero, zero else. Step one, step two. Okay, don't worry about that. I'm just making it hard on myself and on you. So we define these two discrete analytic functions, F and G. And on each edge of the graph, here's our edge, which goes from W to B, we've got three quantities. We've got K, W, B, which is the weight with the sign. And we've also got G of W, we've got F of B, our two discrete analytic functions. And this is the quantity. This is the vector which we associate to that edge. A vector we associate to that edge. And over here, here's B, W1, W2, W3. This vector here, these three vectors, this is going to resemble what we saw in the previous talk, are those three quantities. So this vector here is a complex vector. Which gives you the edge of the polygon and the tiling, it's going to be K, W1, B, G of W, F, G of W1, F of B. This one here is going to be G of W2, K, W2, B, F, B. And the third one is going to be G of W3, K, W3, B. Okay, why do these sum to zero? I mean, there are three vectors, right, which I drew them as zeros. First of all, why are they all coplanar? K is real, is real. F is complex, but F of B is complex, but F, there's the same complex number in each thing. So they're all multiples of the same, real multiples of the same complex number. So they're all, not coplanar, but collinear. And they sum to zero because of this equation. That because G is discrete and analytic, sums to zero, so this guy closes up. Okay, so I'm tempted to denounce it.
What is the summation of a B here?
This is a summation.
And there you sum all W's.
Yeah.
So
this sum, so it's this step which makes it close up. This one is the rule which makes each when you go around a tile, the thing closes up. The reason that closes up is because of this rule. Because of step two. Because here you're fixing W, but you're summing over all the neighbors of W of the corresponding complex vector. It makes these tiles close up. Okay, and then the boundary conditions are made so that it fits nicely in a triangle. So that's still got 15 minutes, right? Yes. Good. That's all the linear algebra. Everything is linear algebra, right? You went a little bit fast here, maybe, but that was just dealing with the boundary conditions. The important thing is that we use the discrete analyticity to make these make this geometry. Now, where you don't see any convexity coming out of this equations. Why, when you solve these equations, do these tiles turn out to be convex? Why is it that you know, we don't get some sort of polygon like this? And why when? So this is kind of mysterious. It comes down to the same mysterious reason that this matrix K is counting. I mean, it's a discrete analytic. It's a D-bar operator, Bill.
Well, I don't want to take up too much time, but I was going to ask that question. I see that on the square lattice, and have before.
Yeah.
But is there a good way of seeing that K is a D-bar operator in general when
is
this sense that it's true? In the sense of this.
Okay, so what you're really asking is, where's the associated Laplacian to this D-bar operator?
Not clear that I'm asking that. If you can answer that, I'd be happier. I mentioned before, I'm happy.
Okay. Okay. So what I propose to do is, there's a proof that these things turn out to be convex. Based on the property of the Castellane matrix, this sign condition, which was somewhat annoying, but this sign condition is somehow fundamental in making this guy complex. Instead, what I want to do is show you the Laplacian in this model, which is kind of a non-obvious thing. Because you don't see the Laplacian. In the graph itself. Because the Laplacian is a function of the original graph with its weights and these two discrete analytic functions. In some sense, the Laplacian is built out of these three, this data, the K, the G, and the F itself. And here I got different colors, so I'm going to draw the planar Markov chain on this graph, and the Laplacian will be the Laplacian of that Markov chain. So here's the Markov chain. said, every vertex has a half plane through it. Every vertex, you can only go to the neighbors to the left and to the right, along the unique edge which is going through the vertex. So from this vertex, you can only go this way or that way. You can't go back. From this vertex, you can go to the left or the right. From this vertex, you can go to the left or the right, and so on. From the corners, you can't go anywhere. Those are sinks. Those are the boundary conditions. Okay, and this one, this edge, there's nothing there. Okay, did I get along? So that's the underlying graph of the markup chain. The weights are proportional to 1 over the distance. Probabilities are proportional to, the transition probabilities are proportional to 1 over the 2, 1 over the Euclidean distances, 1 over 2, 1 over L1, divided by. Okay, well, this is kind of bewildering, probably, because what does this have to do with the original problem? Well, for one thing, with these probabilities, the coordinate functions are martingales for this random walk, right? Because, you take the coordinate function here and there with these weights, this is the average.
So the probabilities are inversely proportional?
Inversely proportional to the distance. What?
This is how you add resistance.
Yeah.
It's also barycentric.
So now I need some more colors. That's too similar. Well, so the claim is that this Laplacian is intimately related to that Castling matrix. And in the last 5 minutes, I'm not going to prove that, but I'm going to show you that the dimer, there's a bijection between the dimer configurations on the pink graph and spanning trees on the purple graph. And we know that dimers are computed with the determinant of the Castling matrix. Spanning trees are computed with the determinant of the Laplacian. I hope so this is called the matrix tree theorem. On a graph, the determinant of the Laplacian on the graph is the number of spanning trees. So what you do is you take the orthocomplement of the constant functions. Take the determinant of the Laplacian on that thing. So the problem is that Laplacian has a kernel. It doesn't, right? But the kernel is, because it's a symmetric matrix, you can just take the action of the Laplacian on the complement of the kernel, the orthogonal complement of the kernel. That has a nice, that's full rank, and it has a determinant, and that's an integer, which is the number of things. Okay, and there's a weighted version of this where you put the, for a markup chain. So give you this illustration of the projection with my different colors here. I need two colors, one for the matching, one for the spanning tree. So this marker chain, by the way, has three sinks at the corners. You can't get out from there. And so on a Markov chain, your spanning trees are directed, they're indirected. So at every vertex, it's not very color. How people feel about the green? I'll just keep bold here. Every vertex, every vertex has a unique path to one of the sinks. And the paths have to make a tree. Which spans all the vertices. This guy, maybe goes back.
That's a sign between them.
It's a random spanning tree. There are many random, there are many spanning trees. I'm gonna give you a bijection between all the spanning trees and all the dimer models. All the dimer configurations. Okay, so in green there's a spanning tree. It has three components. Well, it's really a spanning forest because there's three components, each of which is a tree. Just because my boundary has three sinks. There's a one tree for each sink in your Markov chain. I guess I'll draw in bold pink the that means that's my 2-minute warming.
Yeah,
excellent. Right on time. So when you have this spanning tree, there's a dual spanning tree, which I'm out of colors for, but in yellow here.
It's orange.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to. If I'm trying to get to the base vertex from one of the white vertices, in the dual spanning tree, let me just draw the dual spanning tree in yellow here. It goes like this. You see the yellow? It's a connected tree which leads to the base vertex here. Now we're going to be bricklayers and just lay bricks along the direction of the dual spanning tree. So remember, this black vertex looks like it's underneath the white thing, but it really corresponds to this whole edge. And now there's a unique path from every white vertex in the yellow thing down to here. And I missed one of the edges here. You guys didn't tell me. But that's the one I want to use. No.
It's from the middle parallelogram.
This one goes that way. This what?
It's from your middle parallelogram, the one in the middle to the edge on its right. So that little pink dot at the fucking top right is the edge that's missing. The pink dot.
Pink dot. Which one?
Sorry, the pink edge you're missing. On your original tree.
Yeah, I see. This edge is not here. Because that would not allow. I don't know why I put that edge in the first place. This guy doesn't have an edge. He's got a leaf. Or something. I screwed it up, didn't I? All my nice colors. Let me complete it here, and then I'll deal with that annoying business. This guy goes here, right? Because the tree, I was too cavalier here about drawing the tree. Now you guys are not going to believe anything that I've said. But the tree goes from this white vertex, to this face, to that face there. on your green tree, there's a unique way to complete the matching so that the matching follows along the dual tree. Now, this graph was a little special because there was this edge which didn't have any vertices on it. And which means we have to identify, well, there was a pink guy missing there, wasn't there? So it should have gone like this. I guess it should have gone like that. Okay, well, either you understood that or you can believe you can believe that from this bang tree we get this matching. Now, from the matching, you can also construct this spanning tree. Okay, it's not so hard to do the reciprocal of this construction, and that shows you that there really is some. This is not just a bijection between the objects themselves. If you define the weights appropriately as we defined here, it actually preserves the weights from the matchings to the trees, and so it really is telling you. So to sum up, in the last minute, we started with a graph, a weighted graph, and from this discrete united functions, we constructed this Markov chain here with this Laplacian, and we were able to build this geometry from that graph, and the geometry is actually has been used in the literature in an important way to study the dimer model.